For those of you that weren't here last night, my name's Margaret Scheel and I'm the Provost at the University of Melbourne, and it's my very great pleasure to welcome you to today's lunch. Vice-Chancellor Lynn Davis, Paul Kelly from the Australian and colleagues from the University and the Australian and other parts of the sector, it's a very great pleasure to welcome today the Leader of the Opposition, Bill Shorten. We've heard quite a lot this morning, and there's still quite a lot more to go this afternoon. But one of the great features of this conference is that it brings in together in the same room policymakers together with senior politicians. And we've already heard from the Prime Minister, the Treasurer, the Foreign Minister, and a range of other politicians from both sides. So it's great to welcome Bill here this afternoon. He holds a degree in arts and law from Monash University, but then had the good sense to take an MBA from the University of Melbourne. He worked in a range of parliamentary offices and briefly as a lawyer before being elected as National Secretary of the Australian Workers' Union in 2001, a role he held until he entered the House of Representatives as the member for Maribyrnong at the 2007 election. In government, he has served in three different ministerial roles as Minister for Financial Services, Minister for Workplace Relations, and briefly as Minister for Education. Prior to joining the ministry, he was Parliamentary Secretary for Disabilities and Children's Services, where he was a major proponent of the landmark National Disability Scheme. Many of us became aware of Bill when he was AWU Secretary at the time of the Beaconfield disaster. My stronger memory, however, relates to a trip between Cairns and Melbourne, which started with me having to convince his daughter Clementine that she would really be better sitting next to her mother rather than in my assigned seat, which was next to her father. But the thing that really stood out on that trip was I discovered that Bill was an incurable optimist, because about halfway through the journey, which was 3 hours or so between Cairns and Melbourne, he turned to me and said, "You know, Margaret, we really can win the next election." And I was reminded of that on election night when he came to within one seat of doing that. Which was, I think, from where he was at the time of that plane trip, quite a massive achievement. So it's with great pleasure that I invite him to speak to us this afternoon. Thank you, Bill.
Incurable optimism in a time of uncertainty. I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land upon which we meet, and I pay my respects to their elders, both past and present. The theme that you've chosen for this gathering is an uncertain world. We live in an uncertain world. We live in uncertain times. Yes, we do. We most certainly do. But to varying degrees, we always have. I suppose that if you're a young Australian in the 1960s, where you could be sent to a war in Vietnam, that must have been an uncertain time too. And indeed now, some of you might be concerned about North Korea. Some of you may even be concerned about Donald Trump. Some of you might be worried about Brexit, your superannuation, the share market. And now more than ever, we're all concerned about terrorism. But let me assure you, Australia remains a good place to be. We're peaceful, we're open. We're a country that's always had the courage and imagination to overcome its challenges. My opponent is not an extremist. Neither am I. The media here aren't extremists either. But the people do have a right to be concerned. And it's a concern, I submit today, that springs from the fact that the economy is not working as it should in the interests of working Australians. Australians are asking themselves, their family, their friends, their elected representatives about the country's future and where people fit in our nation's future. They're asking about what sort of deal will we pass on to the next generation. And across our nation, hope, faith in that generational contract is retreating because inequality is on the march. The workers' share of income is at its lowest level in half a century. Too many people are working harder for less. Less money in their pay packet, less security in their job. And for over 1 million underemployed Australians, they're working less hours than they would like to. More and more Australians are part-time or casualised, denied a proper income that they can live upon. They're able to be dismissed or put off or have their contract varied at any time. The Australian Chamber of Commerce and Industry says that the current regulatory environment is hostile to enterprise bargaining. The union movement knows that the current system is letting workers down. People are underpaid, underrepresented, and in many cases, too frightened to complain. In the regions and the suburbs, we're seeing the impact of a new technological revolution where thousands of jobs can be replaced by a handful. Entire industries, like car manufacturing, just displaced. And when Australians are told that there's a shortage of employment in professions, in teaching or nursing or engineering, we tell our young ones to spend years training, but then they take even longer to find full-time work, if they in fact do. More and more of us cannot afford to live in proximity to where we work. We're left relying upon transport systems designed in the 1880s and brought up to the standards of the 1950s or 1960s. And there are very many of our fellow Australians who live from one fortnightly pay to the next, and for them, the hard decisions never stop. And then these people, our fellow citizens, they see the contrast. The most profitable banks in the world ripping people off. An energy-rich nation with rapidly escalating energy prices. And housing prices locking out a generation who cannot rely upon rich parents. In this set of circumstances, I want to say to the politicians and the media commentators who bemoan in terms of Old Testament prophets about the rise of populism, they're just shooting the messenger. And it's no good, this nostalgic pining for the reforms of the 1980s and 1990s, if we do not recognise the defining qualities that made those reforms possible. A voice for working people and the decisions which affect them. Inclusion in the economy, a fair share. Fair pay, a social wage, a strong, world-class, world-leading safety net. Nostalgia does not prepare our nation for the decades ahead. We need a new focus on the biggest threat to our health as an economy and our cohesion as a society, inequality. Inequality in wages and tax, in job security and bargaining, in education and healthcare. Inequality for women in pay, in leadership, in superannuation. Inequality for our first Australians on nearly every measure that we can think of. And inequality for home buyers, first home buyers and renters alike. Every serious economic authority, from the International Monetary Fund to the chair of the US Federal Reserve, is now warning that inequality threatens prosperity. The governor of our own Reserve Bank has spoken so powerfully about the crisis of low pay. Inequality is an economic problem. It is not just an abstract concept. Inequality is why young people, young Australians, are more uncertain than they've been for generations. But it isn't just about young people. Inequality is Australians going for years without a pay rise, but paying more taxes than their boss. Inequality is when women, due to the gender pay gap, effectively work for the first 2 months of every year for free compared to their male colleagues. Inequality is that when families are demoralised because they can barely afford to rent, let alone buy. Inequality is workers in their 50s, in their 60s, displaced, struggling to find work again, job interview after job interview, unsuccessful. Inequality is LGBTI Australians who are just waiting for a parliament to be good enough, to be strong enough, just to simply be fair. And it isn't just the gap between the very well-off and everyone else. It's the gap between those who live in the resource-rich, infrastructure-strong inner cities, of our inner suburbs of our big cities, and those who live in the outer suburbs and our regions. It's the digital divide between access to good NBN and slow, second-rate internet, between well-funded schools and those without resources. It's the gap between our generation and the next. And unless we act on the sources of inequality, then those gaps become tears, the tears become fractures, and the fractures become chasms, permanent fault lines in our country. Inequality kills hope. It feeds that sense, that resentment, that the deck is stacked against ordinary people, that the fix is in, the deal is done. That it's not what you know, it is who you know. That whilst it has always been a factor in your life, the wealth of your parents, that it is now becoming the defining feature and source of your future. That your success in life is predetermined by your parents' income. It fosters that sense of powerlessness that drives people away from the political mainstream, down the low road of blaming minorities, promising to turn back the clock. Inequality speaks to a fracturing of our nation, to a fraying of the old links, the link between hard work and reward, the link between playing by the rules and getting ahead, the link between Australians' daily lives and the political debate in Canberra. I'm all for wealth and for wealth creation. I'm all for productivity increases, I'm all for savings and for profits. And I understand that no government, no matter what political persuasion, can legislate for happiness. But the Hawke-Keating framework, which took government out of some decisions, always relied on the automatic stabilisers working, dealing with what you would expect from external economic shocks, the movement in wages growth, adjusting the exchange rate, the markets. This was the natural part of the system which the automatic stabilisers would go to work in. But we are now seeing weaknesses and uncertainty because the superannuation, which should have gone up to 12%, didn't. Because wages growth has continued to stagnate, that we have jobless growth, that we have growth which doesn't deliver a rising tide of wages growth. Because the bargaining system has become one-sided. Because productivity and investment growth are stagnating. For 4 years now, the Liberals have invested in ideology and not in the nation. Now, the Prime Minister, understandably, takes every opportunity to tell Australians that he's delivering, that he's keeping his promises, that he's achieving, that he's getting things done. In a way, he's right. He has actually given his supporters nearly everything they wanted. There's no advance on climate and energy policy. Negative gearing is still untouched. There's a massive tax cut on its way for multinationals. There's an income tax cut for the top tax bracket. And there is no free vote for marriage equality. Not to mention, there is the cutting of funding for schools and for TAFE and for universities. The penalty rates have been cut at long last. And don't worry about the Medicare freeze, most of that's still there. Oh, and there'll be an income tax hike through the Medicare levy for low and middle income earners. But I want to suggest that reheating and repeating these policies only exacerbates inequality, and it certainly hurts confidence. It's an approach that's taking Australia nowhere. Our country cannot persist with the failed policies of this government, just letting the market rip on jobs and wages. Tax support for investors, but not first home buyers, making it more expensive to go to university at the same time as cutting university funding. Stopping an exorbitant, as the government would say, $365 energy subsidy to people who are coming on the pension, but still handing over a tax cut this year to millionaires of $16,400. People know the consequences. They're living with them. And whilst they watch, the Prime Minister and his party become a vacuum of infighting, obsessed with themselves. They managed to spend days in recent weeks arguing with each other about what the late Robert Menzies meant in a speech he gave 75 years ago. But the Australian people, well, we're left on our own. We've got to worry about the basics. You have to worry about the basics on your own until we sort out what Menzies meant. Left to find a steady job with decent pay, getting some relief from rising power bills, accessing quality healthcare when their kids are sick. The older Australians who right now, across Australia, are putting off refilling a prescription because they have to pay the heating bill this week. When people speak to me in my town hall meetings that I attend, when they speak to me about these issues, I do not think it is a sufficient and respectful enough answer to the Australian people to hide behind some sort of philosophical objection to government intervention. I did not run for Parliament to shrug my shoulders and say, oh, well, the invisible hand, that'll help you, the market will decide. I believe there are things that the government can do and should do I believe there are investments that we have to make, reforms that we have to drive. That is why tackling inequality will be a defining mission for a shortened Labor government. And this begins with taking responsibility, not hiding from it, working with business to drive the industries that deliver decent jobs, jobs that people can build a life around, gain a mortgage around, form meaningful relationships and have dreams and hopes. It's the responsibility to end the toxic politics of climate and energy, creating certainty to boost investment and drive down prices. It's about putting the great Australian dream of owning your own home back within the reach of working and middle-class Australians. And it's investing in Medicare so that Australians are healthier at home and more productive at work. It's about recognising that the system as it stands is accelerating inequality rather than addressing it. It is entrenching unfairness rather than alleviating it. A belligerent defence of trickle-down economics is no kind of plan for Australia's future. Fiddling around the edges won't fund the vital investments in the human capital that we need, from the early years to school to TAFE and university. And simply running the same out-of-touch Liberal game plan of tax handouts for millionaires and multinationals at the same time as standing by and watching cuts to wages and implementing cuts to services. This will only deliver another round of low wages growth, low economic growth, low productivity growth, low investment. It's time for something bigger and bolder than that tired old prescription. A plan for the best. What is wrong with Australia wanting to have the best schools, the best teachers for every child? What is wrong with having the best TAFE and vocational education and apprenticeship system in the world? And having affordable, accessible and world-class universities? Education is not something that we dig out of the ground. Education is the luck we make ourselves as a clever country. It's how we set Australia up for a high wage, high skill, high growth, high productivity future. It remains the best and most enduring and most powerful instrument for tackling inequality. Now, if we're going to fund these vital investments for the future and keep our budget strong, we need to look at the growing and old faults lurking in our tax system. The whole picture, revenue and expenditure, including tax subsidies, including reforms in the past that we might have dismissed as too hard, too politically difficult. I believe Australians are smart enough for this conversation. I think people are hungry for something more substantial than the current political fare. It is time to go to the too hard basket in tax reform and re-examine the issues. Australians are ready for an authentic, no-nonsense debate about whether our tax system accurately reflects the values of our home, of our nation. They're ready for a debate about how our system and who our system helps and what kind of behaviour it rewards. Now, we pride ourselves on being the home of the fair go, egalitarianism. In Henry Lawson's words, we call no biped lord or sir and touch our hat to no man. But he's not describing our two-class tax system in Australia, the two sets of rules. There is one for the vast bulk of Australians, the pay-as-you-earn workers, many of whom have probably already done this year's tax return. They get the group certificate, they fill in the forms, they may go online. Maybe they've claimed a couple of modest vanilla deductions. perhaps $1,500 on the salary sacrifice for the car, your work uniform and boots. This, friends, is the economy class tax system. But then there is the business class tax system, beyond the curtain, where a different tax menu is served, a whole different set of rules for people who are fortunate to have the financial wherewithal to mine the plethora of choices for aggressively minimising their tax. Significant property portfolios, complex deductions, parking the money in offshore tax havens. People with the resources to opt out, to upgrade themselves to the pointy end. People with sufficient wealth to utilise every loophole, to take advantage of every tax subsidy. Now, almost all of this is perfectly legal. But when a nurse on $50,000 asks why someone who earns 20 times more than they do pays less in tax, saying it's legal is not satisfactory. The argument that says that you can opt out if you have more money, and whilst the theory is that everyone can use the same tax act, the fact of the matter is not everyone can afford to fly the business class tax system. If you've made or inherited a lot of money, I have no problem with that, as I said earlier. I do not judge people who have a fortune or don't have a fortune to their name. I don't resent people who have made a fortune or who haven't made a fortune. But one of the great things about Australians is that even those who are personally secure, they are uncomfortable when they see the generational contract broken, when they see a system that's failing the future. And that is at the heart of what we must ask ourselves about our tax subsidies. What are we rewarding? What are we encouraging? What kind of message are we sending about effort and work and making a contribution to society? And what does it cost the federal budget? And the more that people can opt out, how much more falls upon those who can't opt out? We now have a budget deficit racing past $500 billion. In that set of circumstances, I think we have to go back and look at some of our shibboleths. We have a responsibility to look at more than just tax rates and spending levels. We need to look at tax expenditures, tax concessions, tax subsidies. For example, say the government wants to encourage more research in Australia. We might invest more money directly by increasing funding for the CSIRO. Or we might expand a tax concession to encourage appropriately private firms to spend more on R&D. But from the point of view of the budget bottom line, there is no difference in which option we take. Both cost the budget money, either in spending or in foregone revenue. Both involve the use of taxpayer dollars. Both are expenditure. So we should look at them both. Now, governments from both sides have repeatedly tightened our payment system. Today, Australia has the most targeted safety net in the world. That's generally a good thing, except when it goes too far. But it does mean the priority, more often than not, is that the money goes to those most in need. We should apply this same unrelenting rigour to tax subsidies. We should ask ourselves, are the subsidies that are currently in place, the concessions currently in place, working as intended? Are they delivering the value for money? Are they helping the right people? And can Australian taxpayers keep afford to having them? That's why one of the very first economic policies I announced as leader back in 2015 was a tightening of the overly generous concessions for high-income superannuation. What started life as a concessional rate to encourage savings for retirement had become well and truly elongated up the wealth chain. It becomes, for all intents and purposes, for the very well-off, a tax haven. Now, if you've worked hard, if you've accumulated $2 million in superannuation, I do not begrudge you in the slightest. And I have to say, the government finally came to the same view that I'm enunciating. I mean, there was a shocking number of missteps, including retrospective changes to super. But to be fair, the government has partly adopted our policy after years of criticising us. Now, these are examples and changes to super which are an indicator of our rigorous, fair and balanced approach to tax subsidies. Could we keep affording to give overly generous concessions at the top end? Now, we've taken the same approach in 2016 when we announced our plans to reform negative gearing and capital gains. It does feel like a lifetime since Mr Turnbull came to this conference in 2015, I think, and said that everything was on the table for economic policy. Back then, the Treasurer was still talking about the excesses in negative gearing. Yet when Chris Bowen and I announced Labor's plans to only allow negative gearing on new homes and to halve the capital gains tax discount, the government rejected it outright, because they wanted the clearest possible political contrast for a scare campaign. Now, that's always a risk. It's part of the reason why negative gearing, the negative gearing can, has been kicked down the road for more than 30 years. But I want to take you back to that question, or the questions I posed earlier. Is negative gearing, as it's currently constituted, working as intended? Is it delivering value for money? Currently, 93 cents in every dollar of investment goes to the purchase of existing housing stock. That's not creating jobs or housing supply. But there's no question that it does hurt housing affordability. So it is not value for money or the intention of the concession. So is it helping the right people, perhaps? When we developed our policy, we looked at the data, we looked at the evidence. An Australian in the top tax bracket is 2.5 times more likely to be a negatively geared landlord than someone who's not in the top tax bracket. The wealthiest 20% of Australian households own 72% of investment property and 51% of investment property debt. Indeed, 64,000 Australians use negative gearing property to reduce their taxable income to zero. So I don't think these subsidies are helping the right people. Australia should not be giving more support to an investor purchasing their seventh property than a young person trying to buy their first property. Which brings us to that last point. Can the taxpayer afford them? Over the decade, these two concessions will cost the budget $37 billion. Or let me put it in individual terms. It costs the average taxpayer $310 a year to pay for someone else's negative gearing. How do you tell a young couple in Sydney who've missed out on auction after auction that not only is the person they're bidding against getting a tax concession, but they're paying for it? Now, in my 2017 budget reply, I announced that Labor would be taking on another vehicle for aggressive and unsustainable tax minimisation, the massive deductions for the management of tax affairs. This has become a tax deduction for tax minimisation. Now, the average Australian spends $348 to manage their tax affairs. But some of the most fortunate tax minimisers spend an average of $2.5 million. So Labor will be capping the deduction at $3,000 for individuals. Our change will affect less than one in 100 taxpayers, but it will save the budget $1.3 billion over the medium term. The principle is just as important as the revenue. We shouldn't tolerate a two-class opt-out system just because that's how it currently stands. And we cannot ignore unfairness even if there is political risk in remedying it. So in conclusion, the first time I spoke to this conference as Labor leader, I promised that we wouldn't waste our time in opposition. I said we wouldn't fall into the complacency trap. My promise stands. Labor will continue to develop and announce our policies, putting together a program for the future of the nation. Policies that are focused on the sources of uncertainty to tackling inequality. We live in a great country, but if we want to stay ahead of the pack, we need to invest in the future now. Our health system's good, but pressure is increasing. Our energy market has tremendous potential, but the prices are rising. Our growing cities and regions are great places to live. But if you live in the outer suburbs and you're sitting in traffic 2 hours a day because of a government that chose not to invest in public transport or build a better road, you know better than most the price we pay for complacency, for putting off the hard decisions to those who come later. So Chris Bowen, Jim Chalmers, Katie Gallagher, Andrew Leigh, my economic team and indeed my whole party are continuing their hard work on a comprehensive set of policies for a fairer tax system and a stronger budget. We've identified the need, we've agreed on the approach, and I suspect we will continue to lead the debate. Optimism has its place. Sunny optimism most definitely has its place. But in public life, I think it is determination that counts for more. We will do as a government what this government is not doing. We will reduce the uncertainty and give Australians a plan and commitment. I'm determined to give Australians a vision to vote for, not just rely upon the mistakes of our opponents. I'm determined to give Australians an agenda to believe in, an explanation of where they fit in, rewarding hard work, investing in the future, protecting the fair go all round. It will not just be a list of government failures, but a plan to tackle inequality, to restore confidence in our economy. When there is confidence in the economy, then anything is possible. When all Australians are sharing the national dividends of their hard work on a fair basis, then we see things begin to hum. It is the vision we have for families, for businesses, for the future of this nation. That's what we can do, and that's what we will do. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Bill. I particularly like the line that said, say an Australian government would like to invest more in research, given my background, but I would have liked it to have been followed by, and we could invest in research in universities. So, Bill has indicated he's happy to take a few questions. We're on a reasonably tight time frame, so if we could keep the questions short, and I see someone in the front here, I'll go with Paul and then the person behind him. So, Paul.
Mr. Short, the Prime Minister told us yesterday that he intends to reintroduce soon a corporate tax cut bill. As you would be aware, of course, the government got through the Parliament the corporate tax cut bill for companies with that threshold under 50 million. So my question is Labor committed to the position it took to the 2016 election in relation to the corporate tax cut and Labor's desire to better use that revenue? And does that mean that in government you would reconsider the passage of that legislation and not just oppose future legislation but repeal the legislation now on the statute books?
The government has a plan, and the Prime Minister has recommitted to legislating the entire plan of providing massive corporate tax cuts. Mr Turnbull's proposal to provide $65 billion in corporate tax cuts would explode national debt. It would impede economic growth. This tax cut, this $65 billion, would result in massive lost revenue. And this government has been singularly unsuccessful to explain what offsetting revenue it would provide to compensate for the $65 billion. They have a fantasy argument for an unfunded tax cut with no explanation about the sort of growth which would make up for $65 billion and what would happen as a result with no offsetting revenue is that of the remaining revenue, more money would be spent to contribute towards paying off the national debt increased by this reckless decision. So it is an absolute fantasy. Unfunded $65 billion corporate tax cut, no offsetting revenue, increase in national debt, greater proportion of the remaining budget to pay off national debt, it would impede national growth. Let's see what their legislative propositions are, but the case has not been made. And this is especially at a time when companies are recording a higher proportion of GDP and profit, and the share of national income, which is made up of wages and salary, is at its lowest on record since records were kept in 1959. If you want to get this economy humming, make sure that people on lower incomes have money to spend. It's almost like the conservative right's dreams have come true. They're like the dog that caught the proverbial truck. What do they do now? Penalty rates are being cut. 571 agreements were terminated last year. It's on the march. Can hold down wages. But people have discovered what happens when you kill confidence and you increase inequality. People don't have a lot of money to spend. Most people on $50,000 and $60,000 and $70,000, the people who are serving you your drinks here and your food today, many of them don't have any other money to save. They spend every cent they get. So when you depress their wages and their conditions and their safety net, when you ask them to pay more in a Medicare levy, yet you're giving the top end reductions, all you do is you're using inequality to stifle economic growth and confidence. That's why we don't buy the argument on the corporate tax cut. No offsetting income. Complete fantasy.
I'm going to take one last question here. Thank you.
Marie Kennedy from Federal Human Services. Mr Shorten, I ask you this question here because you did address this very briefly in your speech. I'd just like to confirm, are you absolutely committed to lifting some level of inequality from the LGBTI community by maintaining your opposition to the plebiscite?
Yes. Let me use... There are many reasons just to do it. I think that not just the LGBTI community, but Australians generally, just want this matter dealt with. The plebiscite didn't find favour in the parliament. We all know why the government has a plebiscite policy. It's not Mr Turnbull's preferred position, but in many ways he's a leader in name only. He's been forced to do what he doesn't want to do by his own party. You know, if you believe in productivity, we're all in parliament. Trust me, there's the quiet moments. We could have the vote. I don't mind if a Liberal moves it. I don't mind whose name's on the legislation. Let's just have a vote and be done with it. I promise that if it's not done by the next election, that within the first 100 days, if elected, we will legislate it. And I think it goes to something deeper. How can people have certainty when there's not true equality? And it's the same difference. Why is it that gay people have to go through a different lawmaking process to any other Australians? Why is it that when we managed to change the Marriage Act 20 times by parliamentary vote, what's our hang-up? So we're right up for it. We don't mind if Mr Turnbull moves it. Look, it can be as bipartisan, tripartisan, you know, provided there's some Greens left. But we can do it together and we can do it quickly.
Well, thank you very much, Bill, for a really inspiring speech. Before I wind up, I do want to remind you or tell you that the reason the deal is sitting on your chair is that you are quite welcome to take it with you and peruse it over the course of the afternoon, of course, after the proceedings have finished, not during. So with that, could you please join with me in thanking Bill for a tremendous speech?